This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
96. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Securities and Exchange Commission charged former Oregon gubernatorial candidate Craig Berkman with securities and wire fraud.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of the timber industry in a case involving logging runoff brought by a Portland-based environmental group.
And Oregon lawmakers proposed a new bill regulating the use of drones by law enforcement and private citizens.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 20th, 2013. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The Oregon State Senate will be voting on a bill that will allow immigrant college students to pay in-state tuition prices. House Bill 2787 has already been approved by the Senate Education Committee with a 3-2 majority vote. According to a spokesperson for Senate President Peter Courtney, the bill is likely to hit the Senate floor as early as tomorrow. Currently, immigrant college students who already live in-state are forced to pay out-of-state tuition, which is often 3-4 times higher than in-state tuition. The bill attempts to change that, reducing the price of tuition for high school graduates that have attended an Oregon school for the last 3 years and a U.S. school for 5 years or more. They must also be working towards citizenship to be eligible for in-state tuition.
A college tuition aid program involving financial assistance to hundreds of thousands of military personnel was rescued from the federal chopping block today. The Senate has voted to block proposed cuts to the popular program, which covers tuition costs for hundreds of thousands of soldiers seeking continuing education while on combat deployments. The tuition aid program is the latest federal program to come under threat as a result of the sequester, a $42 billion package of federal spending cuts that took effect March 1st. The military announced last week that it would cut the aid program to balance its budget. The cuts would have affected members of the Army, Air Force, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard troops, including 350 members of Oregon's National Guard, according to K2TV. In response to the pending cuts, senators from Oklahoma and North Carolina pushed through an amendment today to prevent the cuts from going into effect during the 2013 fiscal year. If the amendment becomes law, the Department of Defense will have to restore funding to the tuition aid program and balance its budget by making cuts elsewhere.
Lawmakers in the Oregon Senate Judiciary Committee today considered placing regulations on the use of drones by both law enforcement and private citizens. The proposed law requires police departments to obtain a warrant before using an unmanned drone for criminal surveillance. It also requires local government agencies to register their drones with the Department of Aviation. The bill would also make it illegal for private citizens to use drones in order to spy, to trespass, or to hunt. The measure is the first of three drone regulatory bills set to go before the Oregon legislature this session. Another bill, introduced by Republican John Huffman from the Dells, would require the police to delete all data collected from drones within 30 days if no criminal activity is recorded. Proponents of the regulations say they're necessary to protect civil rights, while critics say they could hamper Oregon's growing unmanned aerial vehicle industry. Oregon is one of more than 30 states considering laws regulating the use of domestic drones by government.
The Tigard City Council appears close to allowing social gaming within the city limits. Social gaming includes games such as Texas Hold'em, in which all money wagered is returned to the players in the form of prizes. Oregon state law prohibits social gaming without local government consent, but the law is unclear. Technically, social gaming is illegal within Tigard City limits, yet police report it still occurs because business owners assume it is legal without a specific city ordinance. Business owners called on the council to allow social gaming because of its increasing popularity. The rules for social gaming, if approved, would allow businesses to hold social gambling events one day a week, hold a valid license, and not allow minors in the room where it is held.
Yesterday, both the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Securities and Exchange Commission filed charges against Craig Berkman, a Portland native and high-profile venture capitalist. Berkman was arrested in his Florida home on two counts each of securities and wire fraud. Prosecutors say Berkman lied about owning Facebook shares before they were available to the public and pocketed most of the $8 million received from investors to purchase more. Berkman, who grew up poor on Portland's east side, was the chairman of Oregon's Republican Party from 1989 to 1993 and ran a failed bid for chairman of the Republican National Committee. He was also a gubernatorial candidate during the 1996 Republican primary, losing to Denny Smith with 44% of the vote. Berkman has also been known as a long-term Republican fundraiser since donating $100,000 to George Bush Sr.'s presidential campaign in 1988. He was also a major fundraiser for Senator John McCain's presidential bid. In 2008, a Multnomah County Circuit Court jury found Berkman guilty of defrauding investors and ordered him to repay $28 million. Berkman is set to appear in federal court in Tampa tomorrow.
Today, the Multnomah County Grand Jury reviewed two cases of individuals who were shot by Portland police. First, the grand jury heard the case of Santiago Cisneros, the 32-year-old veteran who was killed by Portland police on March 4th. Cisneros was shot when he got into an altercation with North Precinct Police on top of a parking garage on Northeast Lloyd Boulevard. According to the police report, Cisneros had fired a shotgun at two officers who returned fire and killed him. Cisneros had been in the military for 5 years and was diagnosed both with depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. He lived in Seattle but was in Portland visiting family. Deputy District Attorney Kirsten Snowden says that Cisneros' hearing could take a day or more to conclude. Later in the day, the grand jury released court documents for 50-year-old Merle Hatch, East Precinct Sergeant Nathan Voller, and officers Andrew Hurst and Royce Curtis say that Merle Hatch was verbally provoking the officers in a dark parking lot on February 17th. Police claim that Hatch came running towards the three officers when they shot and killed him. KBOO News will have more on these stories as they develop.
It's the first day of spring, but Oregon's employment forecast remains cloudy. According to the latest state employment report, Oregon's unemployment rate was 8.4% in February. That's unchanged from January and nearly a point higher than the national rate of 7.7%. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 6,800 jobs were added to Oregon's non-farm payroll last month. Most of these jobs were added to the construction, manufacturing, and hospitality sectors. The report also indicates modest losses in other sectors, including trade, transportation, and utilities, as well as professional and business services. Nearly 180,000 Oregonians are currently out of work. However, Oregon's true jobless number may be well higher, as unemployment rates only count those actively seeking work. Oregon's unemployment has been dropping steadily since mid-2009, when it bottomed out at 11.6%. In keeping with a three-year trend, work weeks also got longer for some Oregon workers. Manufacturing production workers now average 40.5 hours a week, up 1 hour from February of 2012.
Researchers at Oregon Health and Science University and the Portland VA Medical Center have developed a potentially groundbreaking anti-malaria drug. The compound, named ELQ-300, is a variant of a drug developed by German scientists in the 1940s called Endocrin. A study published today in the journal Science Translational Medicine showed that ELQ-300 can be effective at treatment and prevention of malaria in mice at low doses. Scientists hope the drug will be safe for humans, though it will be another year or two before human trials begin. The search for new medications to fight the disease is fueled by forms of malaria that are resistant to quinine and chloroquine. Malaria is spread by mosquitoes and kills 1.2 million people annually. Nearly 90% of those deaths are in sub-Saharan Africa, though scientists warn that global warming could expand the disease's distribution.
In observance of World Water Day, the grassroots activist movement Idle No More will hold a demonstration on Friday at the Hawthorne Bridge. Idle No More began with Aboriginal Canadians responding to Prime Minister Stephen Harper's removal of environmental safeguards of Canadian waterways. The group has now become a worldwide movement and has expanded their focus to other environmental issues. The movement has spoken out against the Keystone Oil Pipeline and other government projects they see as infringing on native sovereignty. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with Jackie Keeler of Idle No More about the upcoming Portland demonstration.
Talk about your Idle No More event later this week.
We have upcoming an event on Friday, on World Water Day, at the Hawthorne Bridge at 6 o'clock. It's a water protest. We're doing a prayer.
And what will that demonstration consist of?
Well, we hope to have an elder present to do a prayer over the water. In our traditions, water is sacred. I know in my own tribe in the Dakota, they say, Mini Wichosni Wakan, sacred water of life. The Idle No More protest in Canada actually began with Prime Minister Harper's government, basically removing all environmental protections on waterways in Canada. Many of them abrogate treaties with tribes and violate their sovereignty.
Are you interacting with other groups?
We did choose a location because there is another group, dealing with the fluoridation issue from 4 to 6 beforehand, also doing a protest about water. And we hope to collaborate more with more organizations.
What topics do you see on the horizon for actions locally over the summertime?
We don't have anything quite planned yet, but Idle No More, the main organizing body, actually put out a request for an escalation of activities and more nonviolent sort of blockades and protests, and to continue to put the pressure on the tar sands and Enbridge and all those organizations. Idle No More is the grassroots organization. It was founded by Native women. What I am is I am a Native American woman. I'm a member of the Navajo Nation, and I am very concerned about what's going on.
What stage of the game is this pipeline at?
The Senate's voting on it today.
We've been talking with Jackie. She is affiliated with Idle No More, who will be having a demonstration at the Hawthorne Bridge on Friday at what time?
At 6 o'clock.
This is Robin Ryan for KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Occupy Radio at 6. In this episode, Jimmy Tardy speaks with Dr. Tom Potiowski about the Federal Reserve. We'll get to know Ron Paul a little better, and Portland Rising Tide reveals Portland's top 5 polluters. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is showers with a high of 47 degrees Fahrenheit. Ain't got no jaded
feeling. In a decision issued on Wednesday, the U.S. Supreme Court sided with the timber industry in a fight over runoff from logging. The court held that stormwater runoff from logging roads is not the kind of industrial activity that requires a permit under the Clean Water Act. Although the decision was a setback for environmentalists, the Environmental Protection Agency may still take action to regulate harmful runoff from logging activities. The suit was originally brought by the Northwest Environmental Defense Center, a Portland-based nonprofit. KBOO reporter Quinn Reed spoke to Paul Kampmeyer, an attorney representing the Northwest Environmental Defense Center, in the case.
Can you explain a little bit about the environmental impacts of stormwater runoff from logging roads?
Stormwater runoff from logging roads, active haul logging roads where they're driving trucks along them, is often heavily polluted with fine sediment. And the fine sediment is generated when the logging trucks grind up the gravel on the road surface. That fine sediment is picked up in the rainwater during a storm. And then where logging roads are close to streams, the stormwater gets run through a system of roadside ditches and then pipes, and often dumped into streams. The problem is that the fine sediment and other pollutants in that stormwater is pretty bad for water quality. It increases the turbidity and the total suspended sediment in the water, and that can not only just have problems for drinking water and general water quality, but it often has impacts, adverse impacts to native fish populations. So salmon, trout, in the Oregon Coast Range where this case originated, Oregon Coast Coho, it primarily impacts habitat by covering up salmon eggs and making it so the eggs can't breathe, smothering them, essentially. But it also interrupts the ability of the fish to feed and the ability of the fish to see to avoid predators. So the heavy sediment pollution is just, you know, generally bad for water quality, generally bad for fish, and often drinking water as well.
Normally, you know, when we're talking about stormwater runoff from industrial activity, how does the Clean Water Act regulate that discharge?
So the Clean Water Act requires an NPDES permit, that's a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit, for discharges of industrial stormwater from what are called point sources, pipes, ditches, channels, other conduits. And those NPDES permits set limits, enforceable limits, on the kinds of pollutants that can be put into waters. Also sets limits on how much of a pollutant can be put into waters of the United States. In a context of stormwater, the permits also require the person who owns the facility to implement best management practices. So limit the amount of refuse or dust or other pollutants on the ground so that the stormwater can't pick it up. In other contexts, like a log yard or something, it might require the permittee to build a roof over a source of pollutants, but they're generally just a variety of permit limitations that, when implemented, have proven very useful at reducing pollution to waters of the United States. So the Clean Water Act NPDES permit program is one of the most effective environmental protection devices we have in our federal law.
So how did the Supreme Court justify its decision that stormwater runoff from logging roads is not covered under that permitting requirement?
They basically deferred to EPA's claim. So EPA made a list of industrial activities that require permits under the Act. On that list is logging, but notwithstanding that, EPA claimed in briefs to the court and elsewhere that logging roads didn't require a permit. And when push came to shove, seven justices on the court said, well, we're going to defer to EPA's interpretation of its regulations because that doesn't seem to be irrational or create a direct conflict with the text of the rules.
So given that the court is giving this deference to the EPA here, what does that mean moving forward?
What it means immediately is that logging roads, stormwater discharges from logging roads and other logging activities do not require an NPDES permit at this point. But there's a lot of good language in the court's decision about what qualifies as a point source. I think the court strongly suggests that channeled stormwater is a point source discharge that's going to require a permit if it's industrial activity, which is good law going forward. For these specific logging road discharges, the fact that the court acknowledges these discharges as being from a point source gives Northwest Environmental Defense Center, if they choose to do that, and other organizations an opportunity to continue working with EPA to try to get an effective pollution control program for these roads.
This is Quinn Reed with KBOO News.
Several of the country's largest oil and gas companies have agreed to a voluntary set of new hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, standards in the Northeast. Drilling and pipeline companies can submit to an independent review of their operations, and if they pass the stringent inspection designed to limit air and water pollution, they will earn the blessing of the Center for Sustainable Shale Development, created by environmental groups and energy industry companies. Most of the new standards are stricter than state and federal regulations. The new strict standards will likely make fracking more prevalent in the Northeast by easing state and community concerns about environmental consequences. The standards include limits on methane emissions, the burning of unwanted gas, known as flaring, reductions in engine emissions, groundwater monitoring and protection, improved well designs, and others. Environmentalist groups and energy companies express satisfaction in the cooperation between former adversaries.
The legal battles over the 2010 British Petroleum oil spill continues, with U.S. District Court Judge Carl Barbier ruling that BP's drilling fluids contractor is in no way legally responsible for damages from the oil spill. MILLC, the contractor, has been absolved of all legal guilt, and Judge Barbier also ruled that Cameron International, the manufacturer of technology to prevent blowouts, is guilt-free as well. The case is not over, however, and the rig owner, Transocean Limited, Halliburton, and BP will be calling witnesses to testify before the court. The BP oil spill, which started in April of 2010, killed 11 workers and is considered the worst environmental disaster in recorded history. The spill not only caused the loss of human life, but also caused untold environmental damage to the Gulf of Mexico.
It's 5:23 in the post-meridian. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Apparently, Representative Paul Ryan missed the outcome of last November's presidential election. Oh, wait, wasn't he on the ballot in that election as Mitt Romney's running mate? Well, yes, but less than 5 months later, Ryan seems to have forgotten that he and the Mitster were soundly rejected. Maybe the trauma of losing, including losing his own hometown of Janesville, Wisconsin, has caused his memory slippage. Whatever the cause, it's embarrassing to see him now trotting out the very same Republican budget proposal that he wrote last year and put at the center of the Romney-Ryan national campaign. The same nauseating budget extremism that induced the great majority of Americans to upchuck. Ryan recently headlined a Washington media event for the re-release of this bucket of right-wing hash. It includes turning Medicare into a we-don't-care privatized voucher system that would deliver seniors into the tender clutches of giant insurance corporations, forcing the elderly to pay more for less. Also, in order to save the super-rich from even the slightest tax increase, Ryan again serves up a mess of cuts to food stamps, Medicaid, and other vital programs for the poor, while simultaneously jacking up the tax burden on both the poor and the middle class. Then, to make his package even more odious to the general public, he cluelessly reissues the far right's cry to repeal Obamacare. Hello, Paul. Reality calling. Obama thoroughly thumped you and Mitt on this issue last year, remember? And since the election, Obamacare has grown in popularity, with several Republican governors now seeing the political light and embracing Obama's signature health care reform. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's time for family and friends to circle around Paul Ryan for a sanity intervention, gently trying to pull him out of the rabbit hole he's got himself stuck in.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper signed into law today a bill that will restrict the purchases of guns and ammunition. Colorado has a history of proud gun ownership, but in light of the many mass shootings that have taken place in the past year, including the shooting in Aurora, Colorado last summer, the bill passed with considerable support. The bill requires potential gun buyers to pass a background check and limits ammunition magazines to 15 rounds. While there has been broad-based support for the bill among supporters of gun control and family members of those who have died in those mass shootings, there's also been loud opposition to the legislation. There are already two proposed Colorado ballot measures to overturn this bill. The state of Colorado is unusual in passing this type of gun control legislation. Similar bills have gotten caught up in the political process in Washington and in New Mexico.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, Afghan President Hamid Karzai has agreed on the departure of foreign troops from Wardak province, a strategically important area near Kabul. It is still unclear if U.S. special forces would leave with coalition forces because of U.S. concerns that their departure would leave the area unsafe. Karzai ordered U.S. special forces out of Wardak province last month after villagers accused them of torturing and killing civilians, which has been denied by the U.S.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, March 20th, 2013. Settlers injure a Palestinian boy near Hebron and soldiers attack unarmed protesters and arrest 10 of them. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. As U.S. President Barack Obama arrived for a two-day visit to Israel and Palestinian territories, hundreds of Palestinian nonviolent activists set up a tent village at Bab al-Shams, Door to the Sun, to challenge Israeli settlement policy and the U.S. government tacit support for the settlement expansion. Bab al-Shams is located near the illegal Israeli settlement of Ma'ale Adumim near occupied East Jerusalem. Activists say that the U.S. government is complicit in Israeli expansion of settlements which have taken over much of the Palestinian land in the West Bank in the last 20 years. The Israeli army later in the day surrounded the village and announced the area closed military zone. Activists say troops may remove them soon. In other news, Israeli soldiers attacked nonviolent protests organized at the Old City part of Hebron, southern West Bank. People marched demanding the opening of Shuhada Street in the Old City. The army closed it 10 years ago, allegedly to provide security for the illegal Israeli settlements in the area. During the attack today, troops arrested 10 activists and left many injured from tear gas inhalation, local sources reported. Earlier on Wednesday morning, also near Hebron, a Palestinian child was injured after he was rammed by an Israeli settler car. Witnesses said that the boy, 4 years old, was playing near his home when a settler hit him with his car and fled the scene. Doctors in Hebron City Hospital said the boy sustained moderate wounds and will be allowed to go home soon. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, March 20th news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Ghassan Badmura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Quinn Reed, Aaron J. Bernard, Zeke Harrington, and Jennifer Kemp. The producer is Ben Renner. Our engineer extraordinaire is Kurt Lauer. The KBOO Interim Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Rebecca Ney. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis, 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 o'clock on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Bowman welcomes investigative journalist Greg Palast with the latest on topics from Fukushima to Hugo Chavez. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Per Fogering interviews Mel Goodman about his new book, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, Justin Miller hosts a special edition of Between the Covers with guest Calvin Trillin, the nation's deadline poet, talking about his take on the 2012 elections. He calls it dogfight. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one right now It is your chance to shine. Become a member during our spring membership drive, which starts at 7 a.m. tomorrow. Stay tuned right now for more national and international news from the Worker Run Collective at Free Speech Radio News, and happy equinox.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 20th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on the 10-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Iraqis describe a legacy of sectarian attacks and a lack of basic infrastructure for residents. Others call for accountability for U.S. politicians who led the war. U.S. lawmakers call for changes to policy on Syria as violence continues. And human rights advocates push nations at the UN to agree on an arms trade treaty. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. President Obama made the first stop of his presidency in Israel today, shoring up relations by emphasizing the bond between the two countries. At a joint press conference with the president, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu indicated his government is committed to achieving a two-state solution with Palestinians.
Let us sit down at the negotiating table. Let us put aside all preconditions. Let us work together to achieve the historic compromise that will end our conflict once and for all.
These preconditions include Palestinian demands that Israel halt settlement construction. President Obama said the security of Israel is non-negotiable. Obama said Israel and the U.S. agreed to begin discussions about extending U.S. military aid to Israel beyond the current agreement, which ends in 2017. Federal Communications Commissioner Robert McDowell announced today he will step down from his position, quote, in a few weeks. The Republican issued a statement saying he wants to spend more time with his family. McDowell served on the FCC for more than 6 years. He was an opponent of net neutrality and called for less government regulation of the communications industry. McDowell is one of two Republican commissioners at the FCC. State funding for higher education has been steadily falling, with some states